Hello, fellow freedom likers. Welcome to Legally Drunk. Jake Ubertus, Louis Donaski, Corey Pressel taking over for the next hour. You make sure the next 23 are an exercise in personal responsibility. We got a great show for you here. As always, the Biden administration made its first major antitrust action. Corey has got the top five this week, Corey's picks. And we will break down the New York mayoral race and ranked choice voting. All that and more coming up on the pod, including a rapid fire beer review. I myself this week am enjoying a Whalers Rhode Island APA. Boys, what are you drinking?
I'm drinking the McKellar San Diego First IPA. It's really good, just to spoil it. It's so good I had one before the show, and now I'm having one during the show. And if it sounds like I'm in a tin can, it's because I'm finally in my new apartment and none of the furniture's in the room.
Hell yeah.
And I am drinking what I found in the very back of my fridge because I have nothing stocked, and that is Goose Island's wheat. I really like Goose Island. Typically go with their IPAs, but today the wheat.
Both of you just said things that were like very indicative of our age. Lou just moved into a totally unfurnished apartment with no furniture in it. And Corey's fridge is completely empty except for a random IPA that he just pulled out. But I'd like to start the show, if I may, by saying hello to Congressman Louie Gohmert.
Is there anything that the National Forest Service or BLM can do to change the course of the moon's orbit or the Earth's orbit around the sun? Obviously, that would have profound effects on our climate.
Jake, I still think he's being sarcastic.
No, I think he's being dead serious.
Corey's the tie-breaking vote.
So I don't know the name of the woman who is at this hearing, but her
she's the head of the Forestry Service.
Kudos to her. I could not. When I watched this the first time, her face was so deadpan, and she just took it as absolutely best as she could, and I was very, very impressed.
Yeah, would she say, I'll have to get back to you on that one, or something like that?
She pulled a Jen Psaki.
She did pull a Jen Psaki.
I'll circle back.
It's worth noting to anyone in the audience that when he says BLM, he's referring to the Bureau of Land Management, not Black Lives Matter. If there's anything Black Lives Matter can do to alter the Earth's orbit.
In some conservative circles, they think it can.
Well, yeah. See, the problem with that is that would fuck up the Jewish space lasers if you altered the Earth's orbit.
That's true.
Somebody sent me the funniest meme earlier this week. It was the Drake Hotline Bling setup, and it was Louie Gohmert on climate change, and it was Green New Deal, altering the Earth's and the moon's orbit.
You start. Louie Gohmert is pure comedy in my eyes. He represents a very conservative district, and if it was not him, it'd be another very conservative person. So at this point, he's just pure entertainment value.
I think he was a judge, though. The judicial system, I think, relies on some degree of impartiality, even if their political views are going to lean a certain way. It's why Clarence Thomas's wife being a QAnoner kind of scares me a little bit. So that's a discussion for another time.
It's why Amy Comey Barrett growing up in a cult kind of scares me a little bit.
She voted with the liberals. I was surprised in the Obamacare vote. I was surprised. Good.
I mean, that one, you and I talked about, that one should have been a 9-0 decision, but
you were never going to get all the conservative justices on that. It was never going
to
happen.
To me, it was, I mean, the problem is, to me, the thing was, it wasn't even really an issue of Obamacare. It was just like an issue, the Obamacare element had nothing to do with it in my eyes. It was just like a basic legal principle that if you can't articulate a harm, you have no case.
I'll leave it to the law students.
Switching from some shitty judges to a good one. Today, Attorney General Merrick Garland, or excuse me, early last week, Attorney General Merrick Garland had the DOJ file a lawsuit to block AON's $30 billion acquisition of Willis Towers Watson in the first major antitrust action of the Biden administration. Now, this was big in my eyes, as I believe this demonstrates the Biden administration's willingness to really change the tone and the view of the last really 20 plus years on antitrust. And to the Trump administration's credit, they did begin to file a number of antitrust suits toward the end, mainly after Trump got kicked off of Twitter. This is a really interesting issue in that the Democrats and the pro-Trump Republicans really seem to be on the same page about this, if not for completely different reasons. Now, the more, I don't want to say moderate, but establishment Republicans have really changed their tune on this, and I'll get to that in a little bit. But a little bit about the lawsuit itself. Aon and Willis Towers Watson, if you don't know, are two of the quote-unquote big three insurance brokers, the other one being Marsh McLennan.
And you know what? This is a Chicago hometown Go Cats case. Aon, yeah, I think it's pronounced Aon, is a huge Chicago insurance broker. Willis, right, is the namesake of what was formerly the Sears Tower, now the Willis Tower. So two of Chicago's finest. Be careful what you say, Jake, because the former CEO of the Aon Corporation, his name is all over Northwestern property. Patrick Ryan, it's everywhere.
Yeah, well, if Alan P. Kirby was involved in the lawsuit, I wouldn't be any more sympathetic. Interesting that you mentioned that, because these aren't, while they have certainly a massive presence in Chicago, neither of those two companies are actually based in Chicago. I believe they're actually Irish or English-based companies, and they have an EU proceeding in the merger as well. Although it is largely expected that the EU is, interestingly enough, going to approve this merger.
Interesting.
But they did have Aon, sell close to $2 billion in assets in order for them to approve this merger. Now, a lot of people, especially people on the right, would view the EU as being more strict on antitrust than the US. I don't necessarily think that's correct. I think the EU has just a different emphasis on antitrust traditions than the US does. So to give the audience just a brief overview of antitrust law in the United States came up with antitrust law in a sense. It originated in the United States. This is not something that we got from English common law. This was something unique to America, mainly born out of our robber baron, laissez-faire tradition in the early 1900s and late 1800s. The American system has a very heavy, heavy focus on the consumer. And really, the only thing our system cares about is the consumer. The EU and African and other antitrust principles are more of a balancing test between the consumer, the employer, and very interestingly enough, in my opinion, the affected employees as well. So I don't think it's necessarily a stricter or looser system they have in the EU. I think it's just different. Now, and that could explain the discrepancy between why something might pass in the EU that might not fly in the US and vice versa. To go into a little more detail, the DOJ complaint emphasizes harm to five different markets, including property, casualty risk, health benefits, actuarial services, and reinsurance. Interestingly enough, fields that I used to work in when I was in a reinsurance company. Aon claims that the merger will accelerate innovation and benefit consumers, whereas the DOJ claims it will harm competition and potentially raise prices through the roof. Some in the audience might be curious as to why the DOJ is filing this case and not the FTC. That's because the DOJ and the FTC actually have overlapping jurisdiction when it comes to antitrust. The FTC tends to be conservative, not in the like Republican right-wing sense, but conservative in the sense that they're very, very slow to change. And the DOJ tends to be more quicker to change with the times. So any sort of change in our antitrust laws are going to primarily come from the DOJ. And honestly, it's going to primarily come from Attorney General Garland, in my opinion. Biden did appoint, I don't remember her name exactly, a new FTC head who is more open to antitrust change and antitrust reform, but her hands are kind of tied in a sense.
To your point, to clarify for the audience too, a lot of that has to do with the way those organizations are staffed, right? Because
right.
The DOJ is entirely, it cycles through basically whenever an administration gets elected. So, you know, mm-hmm. swing from Trump to Biden is going to make a big impact. But the FTC is usually, you know, you can appoint an FTC head, but a lot of the day-to-day are salaried staffers, appointees, longtime people from mm-hmm. administrations past.
Right. They're career bureaucrats.
Correct.
The big question, and we don't have a ton of information about this case because it's so brand new and the complaint was just filed, but the main question in a lot of these antitrust lawsuits is more, what is the harm that's being articulated by the DOJ to consumers, and what, if anything, are the net anti-competitive effects? So usually these types of deals aren't shades of black and white. They're not either all anti-competitive or all pro-competitive. And it's a balancing test that the court does. And it's usually on the merger or the business side of things to articulate the pro-competitive effects of the merger. And the government is usually going to try and argue that the net effects are bad on competition and bad for the consumer. So courts are kind of split and on a lot of these major questions and on whether or not you need to articulate an actual sort of oligopoly or monopoly condition, or the mere threat or the mere possibility of the oligopoly condition is enough to warrant a halt of the merger. So this case was filed in the DC Federal Court, and they tend to be more on the side of the threat or mere possibility of raising prices through the roof and abusing pricing is enough to halt a merger. And I think the DOJ has got some good arguments there. In their complaint, they cite a quote from an executive of Aon claiming that they operate an oligopoly in no uncertain terms. Which, if you're unaware, an oligopoly is a market condition similar to monopoly. Instead of one company owning everything and dictating market conditions, it's a couple like-minded ones that own and operate all of these conditions. It's not necessarily a cartel, but you have these instances of coincidental, quote unquote, price changes and things like that. You see it all the time with airlines.
It's easier to function as a cartel if you have an oligopoly in place.
Yeah.
As opposed to multiple companies trying to coordinate as a cartel.
Right. And I think I don't even think that's necessarily the issue, though. I think it's because a cartel requires an implicit agreement, and that's what we call per se illegal, meaning there's no defense to that.
Right, but it doesn't have to be signed in writing. If you have two companies and they're in the same mind, right, to your point, if they'll function as a de facto cartel.
Right, so a de facto cartel. So this is an important point in antitrust law, actually. An actual cartel is per se illegal. Like I said, there's no defense you can raise. You automatically lose the case in that regard, which is rare nowadays. Mm-hmm. And this is all via the Sherman Antitrust Act. A de facto cartel, which would be much more common, is under what we call the rule of reason test, meaning there are affirmative defenses you can raise to that type of thing. And there are general defenses you can raise to that type of thing. It's really a four-step process. I'm not going to go into the whole thing now, but it goes into that net anti-competitive effects question, the consumer harm question that I was raising earlier. So I think that this case will be very interesting to keep an eye on. I think Aon is screwed here, if I'm being quite honest with you. I think Merrick Garland would never have filed this case if he didn't know he was going to win. But at the same time, I think this is going to set the tone for Congress to act. I think this is going to be a call to action for Congress in antitrust reform. I think big tech especially has been the target of a lot of not just Democrats' ire. I don't think ire would necessarily be the right word for Democrats. I think they're more annoyed at the massive barriers to entry in a lot of these fields. I think the Republicans, or more specifically the pro-Trump Republicans, have really expressed ire. I think that's a very apt description of the way they feel towards big tech, if not for the only reason that they kicked Trump off of Twitter.
Mm-hmm. I think with regards to, I think big tech is actually a really good place for Democrats and Republicans to find common ground, if for completely different ideological reasons. The Democrats' problem with big tech is almost exclusive. It usually comes down to two reasons. It comes down to the more traditional progressive Democratic position. Something that I would more commonly hold is that these companies are massive. They take enormous profits. They don't pay taxes. And they're basically becoming these basically gilded 2020 version of Gilded Age railroad companies and oil companies and whatever.
And I think what you mean by that is more so they've reached this market condition where they're more concerned with protecting their own market power than they are with actually innovating and succeeding through competition. That's why Correct. Each successive iPhone is basically the same thing, for example.
Correct. And I think to a bigger point, not to just completely throw Apple under the bus, but when companies get so big, like Facebook, even more so, when they hold all your data, that becomes a little bit scary when it's a multinational that can basically buy and sell your data. They have all this market power to do with it what they want. It becomes concerning to the point of Apple. They don't necessarily have the same push to innovate because the customer base will just move, you know. But the other side for Democrats often comes down to, especially with social media companies, a lot of your fangs. So Google, Facebook, Microsoft.
Instagram. Yeah.
Facebook and Instagram are
Facebook
together.
Owns Instagram, yeah.
It often comes down to promoting online extremism, misinformation, the power that social media companies have as media monopolies is actually equally concerning to Democrats. And then you have the entire Republican side, which is almost exclusively concerned with censorship and banning Trump. But I think you can actually find common ground in legislation to say, okay, it doesn't matter what our motivations are for promoting this legislation. If we can curb back market power and market influence on social media companies or update internet regulations, maybe we can benefit both sides of both agendas.
And I think, not to stray too far away from antitrust, I think if anybody needs a demonstration of just how powerful Facebook is in our society, think about how powerful or how big Trump was on Facebook. And then he got kicked off of Facebook and his own blog completely collapsed in what, a month?
Yeah, if that.
Think about how powerful Facebook was able to make him. The influence they were able to have, and that just can't be undone.
You can see there was a great New York Times report about basically Trump misinformation statements before and after his social media bans. And you could see basically how influential every bit of disinformation he propagated was up until his bans. And then the amount of disinformation that was propagated from Trump basically went to nothing.
Yeah.
It's both good and bad, right? Because like that show, I mean, yeah, Trump propagated a lot of misinformation and it's good that he's not anymore. But at the same time, it does show those platforms basically can breed misinformation for influential figures if they choose to propagate it.
Or and foreign then, governments.
Correct.
Like Russia.
And then those social media companies equally have the same amount of power to basically close off access to any single person should they choose. Even And I will say this, the president, they could do it to Joe Biden. The only thing that is stopping Facebook from doing that is that there's a broad agreement, for example, that, you know, we're not going to cut off political, important political figures, national leaders from, you know, sharing political opinion. But if Facebook, you know, if a bunch of, you know, Republicans took over, they could just say, not that it would, but hypothetically, they could just say, you know what, Joe Biden gets no Facebook forever. And then he'll never be able to be on Facebook. And it's a bunch of unelected gatekeepers.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting the way we treat these social media companies. And we can go on and on forever. But as far as the antitrust element of it is concerned, I see a lot of reason for hope, actually, in this field. It's one of the few areas I'm actually optimistic in. And there is kind of a good news, bad news brewing recently. Minority leader and professional jack-off Kevin McCarthy stated today that he and more of the establishment Republicans are actually opposed to the new antitrust reform legislation that is being proposed, almost exclusively because Biden said he likes it. There are a number of House Republicans who are supporting it, and we will see some of this legislation, I think, move at least to the Senate, where we have actually seen some common ground. So when Trump was president in some of the final days of his presidency, there was a bill that was passed curbing Facebook's power in terms of their ability to monetize and demand payment from these types of media outlets, essentially allowing media outlets to unionize when negotiating deals with Facebook for ad campaigns. And this was actually a bill that was written and sponsored by Amy Klobuchar that got bipartisan support and passed. This was in response to something Facebook did in Australia, where they essentially blacked out media outlets on a partisan basis. And it showed that individual media outlets were at a massive disadvantage. I am hopeful, but at the same time, you know, the Republican ability to quash this scares me, just in the sense that, I mean, I don't know how Republicans necessarily feel about Amy Klobuchar, who I think has done a good job taking up this issue. But for the longest time, the preeminent Democrat on this issue has been Elizabeth Warren. I say Democrat, the preeminent politician, period, on this issue has been Elizabeth Warren. And I think there's kind of this sense in even more moderate Republican circles, like I can talk, like I would talk to my dad, and I think he would generally feel this way, where, okay, Elizabeth Warren is for this. I don't really know much about it, but if she's for it, then I must be against it. And I think that's why antitrust, which is something that in my opinion should have complete bipartisan support, doesn't. And I think you could say a similar thing with campaign finance reform, because Bernie's kind of the preeminent politician championing it. But that's maybe a discussion for another time.
I mean, Jake, you know how I feel about antitrust law, not from the legal perspective, but from the political and the economic perspective. There is usually not an antitrust suit. There is no antitrust suit, usually, that I don't like, because I think 95 to 99% of the time, it is a good thing. The biggest exception being certain things that the government has already taken on. If that's energy, usually the government as a public monopoly will do better with energy grids than
private
companies.
Space travel is another one.
Space travel is another one, of course. Waste management is actually another thing that public government monopolies do a good job with. But in most other situations, the federal government doesn't do anything. In terms of enforcing antitrust law, there was a big push basically in the progressive era and then the New Deal era to actually enforce antitrust law against corporate mergers. And nowadays, I mean, The fact that M&A in finance is such a lucrative, big, very employable field, I think is a problem because you should not.
Law.
You should not. Well, I mean, the lawyers are hired as a consequence of the company's actually.
I mean, Aon employed Latham and Watkins. I'm sure they're making an ass load of money.
The thing is, if it were not profitable for those companies, they wouldn't have put the money in to do it. The financial institutions would not stand to make gazillions of dollars off of it. Law firms would not stand to make gazillions of dollars off of it.
And wait, actually, it might be a bad idea then.
Well, right. The thing is, at the end of the day, those corporations are not actually doing it for consumer benefit. I'm very cynical about that perspective.
Well, I think that's obvious, and I think they would not in a court of law admit that.
They
can't
argue
that. Public opinion, they would admit that.
It's not about consumer convenience. There is, in economics, there is a principle to higher efficiency at scale. That's why in typical economic analysis, you see that most companies, most unregulated markets tend to move towards a monopolistic market, whether that's a monopolistic competition, it's an oligopoly. Usually one or two companies, usually a few, end up taking the majority of the market share because then they can negotiate lower prices on supplies, raw materials. They can dictate market conditions.
And
they become the price setters in markets. And that's
right.
The only thing that really motivates merger and acquisitions on the sake of companies.
And it should be worth noting that a couple of things. You kind of got into what we call the Herfindahlfer, I can't pronounce it, analysis.
You can try.
He's an economist who came up with a test that a lot of courts have adopted for whether or not a specific market share in a given market is allowable when adjudicating a merger. And it's what the FTC goes by. I think it's a little simplistic. It's worth looking at, but I think it's a little simplistic, a little not super practical. It shouldn't be the end all be all. But it's worth noting that a monopoly in and of itself isn't illegal. It's when you exercise monopoly power, like price fixing, like you had just mentioned, that's when it becomes illegal. What my professor would always articulate is, if I build like the best mouse trap or something, and I drive all other mouse trap companies out of business just because my mouse trap's like the best and I'm able to offer the best price for it, and I've achieved a monopoly, there's nothing illegal about that. It's when I use that power to start getting other companies, up-and-coming mousetrap companies out of business who are trying to compete with me, that it becomes illegal. But to your point, and I think this is, to me, the main issue, our legislation governing this area is so old. It's from the 1800s, the Sherman Act and the Clayton Act. I
and
think
it was
it's
used
from
to
the
bust,
early 1900s.
It was designed to bust unions in labor markets. It wasn't necessarily designed to, well, in part.
See, I would actually argue against that. I think some people try to use it that way, but I think it was more meant to protect unions than anything else, at least in its initial form. It may have been used for that at some point. But I think the fact that we haven't amended something like that in over 100 years at this point is the main concern. And it needs to be updated. There was no concept of the internet, no concept of e-commerce, no concept of what commerce had become. I mean, there was no global market back then, really. There was barely even a national market back then. So we need to update our legislation, our antitrust legislation, to get with the times. I firmly believe this quote my professor used to throw around. Lou, I think you would too. There's nothing more pro-capitalist than strong antitrust legislation.
I think antitrust legislation goes a long way to, and enforcement more so. Like,
sure.
Well-designed and strictly enforced antitrust law goes
so you,
a long
you can
way
make,
to
you,
solving a lot of issues and market conditions.
Right, because you can make the argument that our legislation is actually okay. It's more just the enforcement of it that's the problem. But
I mean, I do think the enforcement's the bigger issue. I mean, the fact that they let an AT&T Time Warner merger go through was absolutely insane.
Well, that was litigated a bunch of times, but you're right. They did let it go through eventually. But the big thing, I mean, this gets into agency law and leg reg right here, but I think you can make the argument from the DOJ and FTC's perspective that in order to truly act in a strong capacity or the type of capacity we need them to act, they need a new mandate from Congress. You're only as strong as your mandate when you're a government agency.
Well, that's true. But the other thing is you leave the adjudication to the courts.
Which isn't necessarily a bad thing.
I don't have a problem with that, even with conservative appointed justices. If you come in as the executive branch, your job is to enforce the law. So if your job is to enforce the law, it doesn't mean, I mean, unless Congress writes a law stripping you of your powers, if you're working off of the Sherman Antitrust Act or whatever existing antitrust legislation,
the Clayton Act, yeah,
you come down with an iron fucking fist if you stand by it. And then you let the courts sort out what the merits are of that.
Exactly.
I mean, that's government working the way it inherently is designed to do. You don't need a congressional mandate to enforce a law. You need a congressional mandate to update a law. But the whole point of having the judiciary to adjudicate that is that the executive branch can basically come down however hard they want, and then you leave it to the courts to sort out the mess. But more often than not, if it's a good faith effort on the part of the executive branch and they're enforcing the law faithfully, it's usually not a difficult case to sort out for the judiciary.
Right. Well, you know what, man? There's one monopoly we won't be breaking up, and that's Corey's monopoly on this week's picks. Buddy, take it away.
Alrighty. I'm excited to be doing this for the first time, and I think anyone that listens to the podcast knows that the two of you lean left of center on most issues.
I've never given any hint to my political leanings on this show.
I wear my heart on my sleeve.
I guess, anyway. Jake, then I'm just making assumptions about you. But anyway, I thought it would be fun, being now 5 months into Biden's presidency, to look to the past and look specifically between the years 2017 and 2021. Top five accomplishments from the presidency of Donald Trump.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Okay. Okay.
So are these accomplishments you like, or objectively what his biggest accomplishments were?
I think it's hard for me to say or admit that there are things specifically that I like. I think objectively, most people in the United States would agree that these were accomplishments, is how I
okay.
would frame it.
I have one right off the bat. I have
All right,
one
Lou,
right
go
off
for
the
it.
Bat. I go am for just it. I am just foaming at the mouth. You can see it on the screen. Okay.
I can.
You're going to watch me be nice.
Are you healthy, dude? Because you are foaming at the mouth.
I'm going to go to the hospital right after we finish recording. Anyway, you're going to watch me be nice to the Trump administration.
Go for it.
USMCA.
Not one of my top five.
What? Okay. All right. Okay. Well, you know what? There's an argument to be made that that was a problem he solved a problem he himself created, which is a big running theme with the Trump administration. But Corey, I got number one for you. Otherwise, the whole thing is fraudulent.
Before you say you're number one, I will say that only one of my five is a specific piece of legislation. The other four are just sort of general clouds of things that happened or that he did or that his administration did. But Jake, what do you think number one is?
It's got to be the tax cuts.
It is number two on my list.
Oh, okay.
Can I get some extra salt?
And it's underneath the umbrella of overall economic achievement during the 4 years that he was president. Obviously, COVID threw a screwball into everything. But he did, in many ways, in my opinion, sort of ride the coattails of the Obama administration's economic recovery from the crash in 08 and in some ways accelerated it. So obviously, we know the stock market was crazy. There's a very strong argument to be made that that stock market is not something that really dictates economic success, especially not for everyone. It's just for a very small part of the country. But the stock market was very strong. The tax cuts, although they were in many ways geared towards the very wealthy, between the corporate tax rate and everything else, they did in large part help a lot of middle-class families. When looking at, you know, the doubling of the standard deduction, doubling the child tax credit, those are things that were real for many families, you know, come times for the for tax season, those sorts of things.
Okay.
I mean, the Trump tax cuts are a significant legislative accomplishment in the political sphere. And
that I mean, was Paul probably, Ryan staked his whole career on that.
Like, I, you know, I would never consider it necessarily an accomplishment, but that's my bias. It's something that in the Trump administration, he put a lot of effort into. Paul Ryan put a lot of effort into. And as a piece of legislation to pass, it's a significant accomplishment. I will give credit to the fact that nominally cutting middle class taxes is something that I think is good.
I think the three of us are all on board with that.
And I think increasing deductions for middle class families is in general good. But something that I think where I get frustrated at the Trump tax cuts are that I don't think they are as conservative as Republicans want to pretend that they are in terms of policy, because it's not even close to deficit neutral.
Anyway, Lou, it's your guess.
So before any more guesses happen, I just want to preface that I said that objectively most Americans would find all five of these good. I want to take that back on my number one, because I feel like the number one is so blatantly obvious.
I got number one.
Oh, no.
So in my opinion, but I don't think most people would objectively believe that this is overall great. But
Lou, pressure's on. I got number one.
I'll let you guess.
All right, I'm gonna not say something specific, but I'm gonna say overall the Supreme Court.
You successfully fit under the umbrella of number one.
This
which
is what I do.
So just a couple fast facts, which are for anyone that leans to the left are deeply disturbing. 230 federal judges were nominated and confirmed during Trump's 4 years, including 54 to the Court of Appeals, which makes up about a third of the current judges on the Court of Appeals, which is profoundly impactful to do during 4 years. He also, for the first time in 40 years, filled all vacancies on federal courts. So there were no vacancies by the end of his administration. And of course, as we all know, the Supreme Court now has a 6-3 conservative majority. He nominated and got in three new justices during 4 years, while Obama only had two in 8 years. He had a lot of luck and a lot of whatever you want to call Mitch McConnell's actions between 2016 and 2020 to get him there. But I thought that was definitely number one. And I think most conservatives would also say that that was the most impactful and probably number one during his 4 years.
You know, I'll say that I think we tend to look at or remember presidents for their legislative accomplishments, but I think for more presidents than not, their biggest legacies end up being the Supreme Court justices they appoint. I would even make the argument that that's the case for Obama. I think that's very much going to be the case for Donald Trump.
I will say, as someone very comfortably on the left, Donald Trump's judicial nominations have not completely undermined my faith in the judiciary.
Okay.
Because, and Jake, you can fight me on this, but
I will.
It's a big deal that a president can appoint justices and then get them confirmed. But as someone personally who typically actually errs on the side of judicial supremacy among the three branches of government, I've respected the fact that none of the Supreme Court justices have really done Trump's bidding. In the sense that, yes, you have an ideological 6-3 majority. And the conservatives and the conservative movement really pushed for that as a huge accomplishment. But you come into a 6-3 conservative court and you are not getting 6-3 decisions on cases. And you are not getting the bidding that Trump expected on Obamacare, elections, even abortion.
See, the only pushback I would have on that, and let's pause on the abortion bit of that, because I firmly believe that's coming.
Hold on. The appellate decision denying or ruling against the abortion regulations in I forget which state that is now going to the Supreme Court, the opinion ruling against the abortion law was written by a Trump-appointed justice.
See, this is what concerns me, and I don't necessarily share your view as a judicial supremacist. I'm firmly a congressional supremacist, but I mean that's basically worth jack shit nowadays. But at least in theory,
Congress doesn't do anything.
At least in theory, that's the way I think things should work. Look, you were never going to get people who are qualified to be on the Supreme Court to do Trump's bidding. He would have literally had to have like his kids up there in order to have that happen, which, you know, I wouldn't put past him. But
and it would have been confirmed too.
But yeah, and my worry is more for the social elements of our society. I'm not worried about them screwing with elections or with whatever else you had mentioned. It's the social element of it that I'm very worried about, because those tend to be the elements that have the weakest legal basis for a liberal ruling.
Interesting. And that's a whole nother episode we can talk about.
For sure. And just to check the scoreboard, I'm up 2-0. One more, I win this list. So
All right. Okay.
So we've got 3, 4, and 5 left, and one of them is specific legislation. So any guesses, Lou, to get your score
specific up on Jake? Legislation?
I also got nothing right now, so take as much time as you need.
Specific legislation.
It's how can I?
Oh my God!
This?
No! I know what it is. Criminal justice reform.
Ding, ding, ding!
Yeah.
Number five. Actually, number five on my list. The First Step Act, specifically.
Yes.
Perfectly named, because it truly is just a first step. But it is a first step in the right direction, in my opinion, and I think this is something that had a good deal of bipartisan support when it passed. Obviously, Tim Scott and Cory Booker were pretty influential in getting this bill passed, but it reversed the ban on second chance Pell Grants, and over $300 million was awarded to nonprofits focused on re-entry projects. So that was sort of the focus of the bill, if you're not aware, focusing on getting federal prisoners who were, you know, served their time, getting them re-entered into society a little more smoothly. Because as we know, there really isn't much support in that realm. So I put that number five on the list, specific legislation, and there's two left, number three and number four.
I really do appreciate the First Step Act as a piece of criminal justice reform. I don't think people on the left actually give it credit it deserves.
Agreed.
I hate Trump, but like I think the idea of reflexively hating anything that got to his desk and he signed is not principled. And yeah, if you're someone who leans to the left on whether it's economic issues, whether it's social issues, That's a big victory. That's a big victory for left leaning priorities. I think it's a big victory for like convicted felons, because I think it's a really important issue that no one has had, to your point, the political will to actually address. And it would have only taken a bipartisan approach. It would have only taken like social liberals and small government conservatives to actually come to the table to pass it. And I think that's an unequivocal good step and victory legislatively for the administration.
So I think I got numbers 3 and 4 for you. So I'll give you one guess. And I'm going to say Operation Warp Speed.
That is not on the list.
Did you think about it?
I did.
Okay. Hold on. I mean, I'll let you. I have what I think is
okay. I'll concede that it's incredibly impressive. Given you know the timeline and the severity of COVID-19, to produce a vaccine that by all measures has been incredibly successful. It's incredibly impressive to do that in the time span that it happened. However, I could not separate that from the rest of the administration's response to COVID-19, which I feel was an overwhelming failure.
Look, I mean, the reality is Trump didn't do anything in terms of the vaccine that any other president wouldn't have done.
True.
There's nothing Trump did there that was exceptional. Worthy of praise, am I?
No, I mean, to Corey's point, Trump lost re-election. I've said this all the time, but Trump lost re-election because of his COVID response.
To me, it's the equivalent of Trump with the vaccine.
That was his election to lose at that point.
I agree. It was his election. Lou, I agree with that point, but I think Trump with the vaccine to me is the same thing as Obama with killing Osama bin Laden. Like, he didn't do anything that any other president wouldn't have done. Like, yeah, it's a good thing that they were able to do, but is it necessarily like worthy of praise on their part? I mean, I think it's more of an accomplishment for the country than for the president. But anyway, I digress. I got that one wrong. Lou, you're
okay.
Up.
I'm gonna go in with another swing in the same direction, and that is the CARES Act.
That is not on my list. No more specific legislation, but not a bad guess. Definitely not a bad guess.
Okay, this one might be a little too abstract for the list because it's not necessarily something he did legislatively, but it's more getting so many people who never cared about politics to care about politics and come out and vote.
Number 3.
We take those.
Yes.
Yo, okay.
Increased engagement in our government, for sure. And that I think is something that maybe the Trump administration would not want to admit was an accomplishment of his 4 years.
They were so engaged, they raided the Capitol building. I mean, come on, what more could you want?
Well, that's true, but fortunately in the case of the 2020 election, that engagement went both ways. Record high turnout, more votes for both a Democratic and a Republican president than ever before. Over 80 million for Joe Biden, over 74 million for Donald Trump. That's incredible. Turnout, I think, was over 65% for a presidential election. That is awesome. And beyond just voting, millions more, yes, obviously voted, but protested as well and showed interest in our country, in the direction that our country was going, and in many ways to stand up against the things that were happening, starting all the way on January 21st, 2017, with the Women's March. It was a really good first step in that direction in getting more people engaged and talking about it. Yes, so only number 4 remains, and I will give the clue that this isn't something specifically that I think this would have happened under a president from either party. That will be my clue. I don't think it's specific to Republicans or conservatives. I think this is something that would have happened either way. Maybe not, but it's an accomplishment that definitely the Trump presidency would tout.
A renewed emphasis on the economic threat of China.
Not a bad guess, but not number four.
I was thinking something along those lines, maybe something with Rocket Man. You wouldn't have gone, I don't think you would have gone moving the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. That was pretty minuscule, but it was something I thought was a decent thing.
I don't think that's something that would have happened under either side. I think that is something that strictly would have happened.
Okay, yeah, so I
got to
keep that hint in mind right. as well. I was going to see when you said that, I was thinking like, oh, something like the climate accords, but he pulled out of that. Something like the nuclear deal, but he pulled out of that.
Think about when people characterize Obama's successes. Think about what would be on his top five.
I got it. So Trump getting rid of the individual mandate.
No.
What an idiot.
Damn it.
That's a specific thing.
Yeah, it's a specific
thing. Think global.
I guess you would think of that as a failure more than anything else because he didn't kill Obamacare.
Think global.
Think security.
Oh, he ended the war.
I would not characterize it like that at all.
He ended all the wars, Corey.
You're really close. You are really, really close.
Donald Trump is going to knock the crap out of ISIS.
I'm just going to say it at this point because I think – so my general umbrella term was which I think this one of any of the points is up for the most debate. But as we tend to see under Republican or conservative administrations, obviously he rebuilt the military in terms of the amount of funding. That's a term that I know. I shouldn't have said it like that. I shouldn't have said rebuilt. I take back that.
Guns out, dudes. Guns out.
Not rebuilt. He threw a lot of money towards the military. Specifically, I'm looking at the killings of al-Baghdadi and Soleimani. So that's where I was trying to relate Obama. I think a lot of people would consider one of his biggest achievements taking out Osama bin Laden. Yes. So the killing of al-Baghdadi and Soleimani. So my general umbrella was emphasis on the military. I included Space Force in there, which is kind of funny. It's very early to see what is going to become of the Space Force. And the last thing I'll say about this is, which I think a lot of people can get behind, three pay raises during his 4 years for service members, active service members. So,
yeah, but that was something that's happened under every president. Like, he totally lied when he said he was giving them the first pay raise. It was just a flat out lie.
It's something that happens. I don't discount or disagree with you that it's something that happens under all administrations, but I think it was slightly heightened in terms of probably the monetary amount, I guess, during his term. And if you think about it, the military, in terms of voting, as a voting bloc, was largely behind Donald Trump in really dramatic ways. So obviously there was a lot of support there. So they liked what he was doing. But I think that the things I would highlight most about my general umbrella there would be the killings of those two guys.
So what I would push back on, to one extent, is I think the killing of al-Baghdadi would have happened under either administration. I do not think the killing of Soleimani would have happened under a Democratic administration. I think that was a really, really controversial call politically, not morally about whether or not they should or should. Morally, Kim Jong-un should be assassinated too, and you should replace the North Korean government. Okay, that's what I think is a big human rights issue. But in terms of like, can you politically do it? Is it politically ethical to do it? Is that the right way to do it? No. So like, I think Soleimani's the same way. You could say he's a huge threat. You could say he was a state sponsor of terror. Say all these things. I don't think a Democrat would have done it. I think that would have been way too controversial a call for someone like Biden, Hillary. Obama wouldn't have done it. I think in terms of rebuilding the military, or at least dumping funding into the military. You could see a Democratic administration do it. You just see it be done in different ways. For example, funding the VA appropriately would be a thing a Democratic administration might do that would also bloat the military budget in a way that, like, you know, like, well, just paying for an F-40 or an F-30 jet would also bloat the military budget. But
to me, the phrase "rebuild the military" pisses me off so much, because that implies I know it's not you, but that just implies that Obama cut military funding, which isn't true. Military funding increased under Obama. He just didn't increase it nearly the amount that had been done.
Well, I think that's to Corey's point, where like it would be like increased military funding was likely to have happened under either administration.
Yeah.
Like the Biden administration in their upcoming budget doesn't actually propose significant military cuts from the Trump administration budget. So like the military is like a group within the United States government. It's usually not the thing that's on the chopping block.
Right. So Corey, run through the list for us one more time.
Sure. So number one was judges.
Mm-hmm.
Number two was the overall economic achievement in different ways. Number three was the increased engagement in the system of government, in just voting, protests, those sorts of things. Number four, the most controversial, was rebuilding of the military, introduction of the Space Force, and the killing of those two men. And number five was the First Step Act.
Good list. He came out swinging with Corey's picks.
Thank you. Thank you. I thought this one would be fun. I thought this one would be a really good introduction from me. And I promise the next ones won't be so Trump-centric, because it was 4 years. I was really tired of it by the end. And I just brought us back to it. So I'm sorry about that.
All right.
I really appreciate, I mean this, being pushed to think about things that Trump did that were not absolutely atrocious.
I agree.
I still am mad at the justices issue, but in terms of other issues, I like trying to think of the positives. I just hope that over the course of the next several years, we don't launder Trump's reputation and be like, well, it wasn't that bad.
The same way we've done with Bush that drives me up a wall. I mean, this guy was arguably the worst two-term president in the history of this country, and we look at him with rose-colored glasses.
But see, he was the worst until Donald Trump.
Two-term. We'll see if Trump wins a second term.
All right, maybe. I mean, he did. It was all fraud that he
Oh, my did. Bad. All right, well, that'll do it for Corey's picks. Great list. Let's towel off. We'll come back with the New York mayoral election.
At the time of the recording of this podcast, the New York mayoral primary is happening tomorrow, Tuesday. We're recording this on a Monday evening. Tuesday, June 22nd, is the New York mayoral primary. And it is probably the most significant election that is using ranked choice voting instead of traditional first-past-the-post voting in a primary or a general election. Ranked choice voting is also known as instant runoff voting because of the way the algorithm of ranked choice voting works, which is that you rank a certain number of candidates depending on the rules of the election, your top three, your top five, all of them, and the lowest, or the person who has the lowest number of first choice votes is out. And then everyone who voted for that person as their first choice, their second choices of those ballots gets moved to the remaining candidates until someone reaches 50%. And so basically every time you cut a candidate, It's a new runoff. That's why it's called instant runoff. Cut a candidate, move their votes to someone else. Cut a candidate, move their votes to someone else. Eventually, you get to a majority, and that person wins. Now, it doesn't. In most situations, it's a 50% threshold. You just need to get a majority. You can change those rules how you want, but that's how most people think of it. Get to 50% eventually, and you win. If a primary candidate or a general candidate gets 50% right off the bat, there is no runoff. So that's the other piece of it in those rules. If you reach the threshold the first time, it doesn't matter. This is a big step for a lot of proponents of election reform to actually get an instant runoff voting system or voting method in a major election. I'll say this.
You're more bullish on this system than I am. It's not that I kind of poo-poo it. I'm in favor of it, but I think you think it'll have a much bigger impact than I do. So I'll go ahead and bite. Why ranked choice voting?
Well, actually, I was going to say I was a huge bullish proponent of ranked choice voting until basically I took this new job as running the Somerset County Democratic Party. And I say that not in the sense of I'm against ranked choice voting on the whole. It's that I think you might begin to trade some problems for others. So, for example, I think the case for ranked choice voting, and I still stand by this, is I think ranked choice voting breeds or favors consensus candidates. So if you know, when you have a primary election in particular, I think this is important. So it's why I'm actually very enthusiastic that it's happening in a primary election. When you have a primary, typically, especially on a Democratic or Republican side, usually the method is cater to the base, cater to the base, cater to the base. But usually that leads to more polarization.
So and more extremism as well.
Correct. So when you have ranked choice voting in a primary, you basically are, you know, one person might have, if you have a diverse field of candidates, so if you have 3, 4, 5, 6, basically more people, you will basically narrow into a consensus pick.
The golden corral of politics, as Mike Huckabee used to call it.
Right. You don't have. If you have 6 people or more splitting the vote, it's very unlikely someone gets to 50%. So a lot of people's second choices end up becoming the candidate. And I think that breeds party unity, for example. I also think that breeds, I think that favors and breeds nominating candidates that are likely less extreme. And I think that's a good thing. The other pro and why I'm bullish on it is I think it dismantles a two-party system, which is actually against my interests working for a political party. But I think
a not a political party, the political party. That's what you work for.
Stop. A political party. And...
Look, the noble asses are not just a political party.
We have good asses, but it does inherently favor or disadvantage or discourage a two-party system, which I think is good in the sense that a duopoly of two parties is not necessarily a good thing for public policy making. You and I have spoken many times on this podcast about how I think a parliamentary republic is a better move than a presidential republic, and how you and I don't agree on that, but
not even a little bit.
Notwithstanding, I'm starting to see where the cracks of ranked choice voting fall, and I see them in two different ways. The first one is actually something I would not have thought about until 2020, basically, and until January 6th. And that is ranked choice voting is an algorithm. And this is actually something that is talked about in, we talk about it, I talk about it with elected officials, I talk about it with colleagues, I talk about it with candidates. There is political momentum in the Democratic Party to do ranked choice voting. There's a fear that it will breed more conspiracy theories about voter fraud and election manipulation, because at a certain point, what is happening is an algorithm. Voting machines are really better equipped to process that data than a hand count, because a hand count of ranked choice ballots would probably be quite excruciatingly difficult. And after how quickly conspiracy theories in the United States propagated with voting machines, there's even a concern about even bothering with electronic voting machines anymore. A lot of it is now a debate of what can we have the most receipts for? And so I think you might actually breed more conspiracy theories with a ranked choice ballot. There's a case to be made there than just doing a first past the post where it's one or the other. And I think the other rebuttal to ranked choice, which I think is interesting, is that, yeah, from the interest of a political party perspective, you do diminish the power of political parties, which I don't, I'll say it personally, I don't mind that. I think it's a good thing. Agreed. What I'm not sure is a good thing is, say, a third choice. Say a third choice for most people ends up leapfrogging into the first position, or a fourth choice for most people ends up leapfrogging into the first position. You can consensus vote someone basically into an undemocratic election, right? So if you, like, say you can't come to a consensus, like you have six people, seven people, and it's split basically 15-12% across the way, whatever 7 divided by 100 is. The way alliances can work, the way, you know, you're seeing it unfold in the primary here between Andrew Yang and Catherine Garcia, for example, it almost lends itself to this alliance building where you could get everyone's third choice candidate winning. Is that the most democratic way to elect someone? If no one actually wanted them, or even the minority of people voted for that person.
I mean, can you win with zero first place votes?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. I mean,
I think is actually a problem.
Yeah. I mean, look, there's a lot. I think you can critique every electoral system. I mean, there's no system that's perfect. You can win the electoral college as currently constructed in the United States with, I think, 12% of the popular vote, which is beyond absurd. But I guess you kind of need to do a cost-benefit analysis of how likely is that ever to happen. One question I had for you before we get into that is, and you kind of alluded to this earlier, what's your feeling on ranked choice elections in generals, not just in primaries? Or is there even a difference in your mind?
I don't think in the current United States a federal election system, a general, like ranked choice voting in a general election, does anything. I don't. In order to make ranked choice voting in a general election matter at all, is to basically do a national popular vote and to have nonpartisan congressional districts. Otherwise, I mean, it's not going to make a difference. So while you could do it, I think in practice, in a general election, it will change nothing as the system currently exists.
Right. Because I think, I mean, maybe you could say, take 2020, for example, there was a contingent of people. Corey and I know some people, for example, who voted for Joe Jorgensen weren't necessarily Trump supporters, didn't like Biden either, or maybe even people who voted for like a Bill Weld type, who kind of these never Trumper Republicans who in a ranked choice system would have likely put Biden as their second choice instead of putting nobody or putting Trump. Mm-hmm. And you can make an argument that, yeah, they should be allowed to do that, but at the same, like that would be good for them. But at the same time, that wouldn't have influenced any sort of outcome in any meaningful way. I don't think in the slightest.
No, and I think the issue with ranked choice voting in a general election is you're right. Joe Jorgensen's votes would have all just gone to the second place person. Now, we don't know, but who everyone's second choice would be. But I don't necessarily think that changes the outcome of the election.
Even in Georgia, where it was so tight and Joe Jorgensen got like a decent percentage of the vote.
I still don't agree. I still don't think that would make a difference. And I think to an extent, while I tend to like ranked choice voting on paper, I do think you're trading drawbacks. And you have to, I guess that's every political party's choice. It's every government's choice of what trade-offs do you want in your election system. And maybe now, we'll see, because New York is a huge, important test of ranked choice voting. If it's a huge success, maybe that sets the path for other political parties and states and municipalities and whatever to be like, yeah, this is going to be a good thing. It's not going to cause problems. And it's going to secure trust in our election system, for example, if that's your goal. Okay. But if it's a mess, I feel like you're going to deal with a lot of political blowback and it's not going to gain the traction that proponents are hoping it gains.
I am beyond incredibly dubious that at a federal level, especially, this would restore anybody's confidence in elections. And I think to what you had alluded to earlier, it may even breed more conspiracy theories. Now, I kind of teeter back and forth on that because, one, I think primaries are less likely to induce conspiracy theories. But at the same time, I mean,
Pete versus Bernie in Iowa. I mean, that was a conspiracy theory.
Well, I was going to throw out Trump losing to Cruz in Iowa in 2016. Trump claimed that the election was rigged then, and he claimed that there was fraudulent mail-in votes and whatever, even in the Iowa caucuses in 2016. And part of me thinks it's more just a Trump thing than anything else, but I could sadly see this being a staple of our electoral system.
The problem is, you're right. Like, you can say, oh, it's a Trump thing now. But after January 6th, the conspiracies have basically become a mainstay, unfortunately. And I'm not convinced that they, after basically we saw what people could get away with in propagating those conspiracy theories, I'm not convinced that they will go away anytime soon. I want to pass this off to Corey, not to put you on the spot, but where do you fall on the first past the post ranked choice? What is the system of choice if you could wave a magic wand?
Oh, I have no idea. I don't know.
And I think that's a very fair answer, Corey, but continue. Yeah.
I mean, I agree with what Jake said, that there is no perfect system. I think I struggle with the United States specifically in thinking about a two-party system and the way that our elections work now. Obviously, electoral college is something very different. It would be interesting to see how a ranked choice system would work obviously it couldn't be 50% in a general election in the United States, because seldom does a candidate actually reach 50% now. So I thought about that when you mentioned that earlier. Obviously the number could be lower, but I would be curious to know sort of how that would all play out. But to answer your question, Lou, I have no idea. I do not know. That's something I'd have to spend a lot more time thinking about.
And I think that's the goal, just trying to open up the conversation. And we need to be, I think, more open to change in our system.
Yeah, I think the idea of just not necessarily accepting the status quo as it is a good exercise. And, you know, like to Jake's point too, yeah, maybe it doesn't restore confidence in elections per se, but the fact that it's starting at least at a municipal level, you can see when the stakes are just a little bit lower, what comes from the aftermath of it. And you know what? Like, it's a good way to beta test a reforming government. Frankly, I think the way it ought to be done more often. So I'm going to give props to New York City for actually, you know, putting it to the test. And if they run it well, we'll see. Maybe it becomes the domino that tips, the first domino that falls in a chain, and then everything else goes after it.
Well, that's what the good old laboratory of democracy is for, and certainly a race to keep our eye on. Tomorrow is going to be a very, very interesting day. Go Yang. Why don't we get into the rapid fire beer review, if we may? Gentlemen, let's keep it concise. Who wants to go first?
Concise, I'll go first. This is the Mikkeller Burst IPA, 6%. Four pack was $15, so fairly expensive. It's a West Coast IPA, clean, uses only four ingredients: water, barley, hops, and yeast. Eminently drinkable, 6%, so not too strong, not too light, good malt backbone. I'm giving this a 9. I could drink this for days.
Damn, that's pretty high praise. So I got the Whalers Rhode Island Dry Hopped American Pale Ale, good old APA, which I actually tend to favor over IPAs personally. I know that's not necessarily a super popular opinion, but good old 5.5% out of this bad boy, made in Rhode Island, because, you know, I love my cousins. I gotta say, wasn't expecting much out of this, and on first, you know, few sips, I thought, you know, this isn't bad, but it's nothing special. But I found myself finishing it pretty quick, very smooth for an ABA. I gotta give it a lot of props for that. It hides the alcohol fairly well. And I think I'm gonna go ahead and give this a 7.5. I don't think it does anything necessarily exceptional, but it does all the basics very well.
Well, this is exciting because I think we all have pretty good beers. I will rank mine the lowest, but I have Goose Island's 312 Urban Wheat Ale. I really like Goose Island. I tend to go with their IPAs. They do a lot of IPAs really, really well. This is only 4.2%, 18 IBU. It says that it's bright, lemony, and a bit hazy on the can, which I would agree with. I didn't fully get the lemon. It honestly tasted a little spicy to me. Nothing overbearing or anything like that, but overall enjoyable. It was fairly smooth. I also drank it pretty quickly. I'm an avid Untappd user, which is like a beer social
media
app.
They're not a sponsor.
No, they are not. But they do rankings on a scale of 1 to 5. And I checked this 312 in at 3.25, which I think people tend to be a little bit harsher on that app. But anyway, for the sake of a 10-point scale, I will double it and I will land on a 6.5.
Nice.
All right. Very nice collection of beers there. Go out and check those out for yourself and let us know what you think. Thank you for tuning in. Thank you, Lou. Thank you, Corey. And until next time, we're out.